This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. On this week's program, we hear from a young boy in Ghana about life after slavery.
I want to teach my friends and tell them some story.
I want to teach my friends and tell them some story about my life so they can learn something.
Plus, bakeries in Pakistan hit hard times. It's not just the dough that's rising, it's the price of wheat. And one man's quest to bring baseball to Africa against the advice of his mother.
Well, mom said, yes, I want you to stop playing that game. That game, you can't play. This game, they play it in America. They don't play it in Ghana.
That and more just ahead. First, this hour's news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. An earthquake shook Pakistan a few days ago. Hundreds died. Thousands more have been left homeless. It was the last thing Pakistan needed. The country is struggling with Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces on its border. And the high price of food has people strapped. It's not just consumers who are feeling it. Will Everett reports from Peshawar in Pakistan.
In this small bakery located in a quiet neighborhood of Peshawar, bread is made the way it's been for generations. First, you take a huge slab of dough and divide it into softball-sized lumps. Roll it out into a flat disc about the size of a plate, then stamp it with the baker's trademark, a round, spiky device called a tapak. And finally, you slap the flattened dough against the wall of a glowing mud brick oven. It takes about 5 minutes to bake the loaf, called a roti. By the end of the day, this shop will have made 700 to 800 rotis for a steady stream of customers. The owner, 29-year-old Shah Mohammed, has been doing this since he was 12 when he began learning the trade from his father. He says his profit today will amount to just over $10, a record low.
Wheat prices have nearly doubled. Last year, a bag of wheat cost me 1,200 rupees. Now it costs 2,300 rupees. I made a good profit last year. But now, if I stick to the official price of bread, I can make nothing.
In Pakistan, the price of bread is controlled by the government. The official price of one roti is 4 rupees, or about 6 cents. But at that price, Shah Mohammed says he only breaks even. So he sells the bread illegally for 5 rupees.
I don't like raising my prices, but what are my options? If I sell bread for 4 rupees, I'm making no profit for myself or my employees. How long am I supposed to work for nothing?
He says an inspector comes around to make sure he's selling rotis at the government price.
You never know when the inspector is going to drop by. It's always a surprise. He asks how much I'm charging, then threatens to throw me in jail when he finds out I'm adding 1 rupee. Then I have to pay him a bribe of 500 rupees. It's always the same.
Shah Mohammed buys his wheat at a local wholesale market. I go there to find out why its price is on the rise.
My name is Varman. The shop is named Superfine General Store.
Vermont explains that all of his wheat comes from mills in the fertile Punjab area. He says that there's no shortage of grain in Pakistan, but it gets waylaid. Some dealers smuggle it to Afghanistan, where prices are higher. Others hold on to it, anticipating higher prices in the future.
We are Muslims, and this violates our religion. The Quran teaches us not to hoard grain for personal gain, but this is what you see happening right now in Pakistan.
The mill owners I contacted for this story would only say that grain prices are driven by market forces beyond their control. Vermont says that whatever the reason, the situation is becoming critical.
When people don't get enough bread, it can lead to revolution. And how can people get bread if no one is left to bake it?
Back at the bakery, Shah Mohammed is shutting down early. It's been rainy and sales have been slow, so he's letting his men go home for the day. He's cleared about $5 today, which he'll share equally with his 4 employees. He says he doesn't believe he has a future in bread making.
I don't think I'll be baking bread next year. I'll probably have to find work as a day laborer. I'll make the same money, but with fewer worries.
Before they leave, Shah Mohammed and his assistants make one last batch of rotis for themselves and their families. Their faces are stained with sweat and powdery ash. They tear open the steamy bread and pop it into their mouths. Shah Mohammed grins, enjoying this one consolation of being in the bread business to the fullest. For the World Vision Report, I'm Will Everett in Peshawar, Pakistan.
Global food prices were rising long before the current economic crisis. Now it's even more likely that people in developing countries will be squeezed into poverty. Aid groups have usually delivered food to the hungry. But now, some aid groups are trying something different. They're giving cash. Rob Crilly reported on this for the Christian Science Monitor. He visited a remote part of Kenya where post-election violence had made it nearly impossible for villagers to get food. An Irish aid group wanted to help.
They found that in this area, there were lots of families who were going hungry, yet they were surrounded by all the things they needed for a nutritious diet. So they've come up with the idea of distributing cash to families in need.
Well, it certainly makes sense. How exactly does this work?
Well, the delivery system is another fascinating part of this program. In Kenya, there's been a very successful money transfer system set up through one of the local mobile phone networks. And this allows an individual in one part of the country to send money directly to an individual in another part of the country. They would pay however much they want to send to a local agent, and they would get a special code, which they then send via a text message to another individual in another part of the country who can use this code to collect the money from a second agent. And the charity has used this system to inject some $25,000 into the mobile phone network. So they see this as a very fast and efficient way of getting money to people in very remote areas of the country. Kenya, like much of the developing world now, has quite a good mobile phone network.
How does the aid group ensure that the cash that's getting to the people is actually used for purchasing food?
Well, this, of course, is one of the major questions. And in order to try and make sure the money is being used in the proper way, there was a fairly careful screening process used. So first of all, the families who were selected were people who had suffered in some way in recent post-election violence. Maybe they'd had all their cattle stolen or lost their goats, or maybe a breadwinner had been killed. So the first thing was to target the people who really needed the money. The second thing was that women were targeted, and this is something that has been used in other projects when maybe food or mosquito nets or other things are being handed out. If the person that this is given to is a woman, it often is more likely to get to the people who need it, her children, or it's used in the right way. And finally, they have been monitoring exactly where the food has, where the money has gone.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you heard from the people who were being a part of this program, how they were experiencing it?
Well, naturally enough, people there were hugely excited about this program. I met plenty of people who said they hadn't had a proper meal in 3 or 4 weeks. They were reduced to picking wild berries from the trees and making them into a porridge. That was about all they'd been able to eat. And people had dropped from maybe 2 meals a day, which is the norm in that part of the world, down to just one. So these people were hungry. They were malnourished. So there was a huge amount of excitement that this cash was arriving to help them.
Now, you mentioned that there's plenty of food around for these people, and in many places that the problem isn't lack of food, it's lack of cash. So I'm wondering if bringing cash in also stimulates the local economy, because these farmers are probably eager to sell their food.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this process has a lot of benefits. I mean, this program is being run in the Kerio Valley, an area in western Kenya that sees a lot of rainfall. There's lush vegetation, and really, if you plant anything in the ground, is going to grow. So during my visit there, I saw marketplaces filled with food, with great looking avocados, and we saw plenty of fat goats who looked juicy and ready for the eating. But the problem is that many of the people in the area had lost their incomes. They had lost their own goats or cattle, or maybe they'd had supplies of grain stolen. So the advantage of this is that it stimulates the local economy. Dumping sacks of maize in these areas, which is the traditional way often of tackling hunger, would have simply undermined the efforts of local farmers and markets and so on.
I'm also wondering if there's some resistance on the part of Western aid agencies to switching from giving food directly to people who are hungry to cash. Because, you know, in this country, food aid started as a way of giving away American surplus to other parts of the world. And it's actually a big business with farmers here and aid groups. So how likely is this system to totally change? It's a big system.
It is a big system. And very often, these sorts of organizations move very slowly. Delivery of cash has been trialed by the United Nations World Food Program, and we're beginning to see them start to make a switch. Now, it's never going to change completely to cash. There are always going to be areas where there are droughts and famine, and there's simply no food available. So food is always going to be a part of the aid system.
There have been many reports lately, Rob, on the impending famine all across East Africa through countries like Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya, where you live. What are you hearing about this?
Well, I mean, the latest estimates suggest that some 14 million people across the Horn of Africa are in desperate need of food assistance. The worst affected country appears to be Ethiopia, where a succession of failed rains have pushed some 7 million people, possibly more. We're expecting new assessments. We're expecting these figures to keep rising up. But we're hearing some 7 million people at the moment on the brink of famine.
Mm. So in a case like this, it's the traditional food aid really is the only option here, which is shipping and dropping in real food, not cash, correct?
That's right. I mean, the key is tailoring the aid response to the need. And I think in the past, too often the assumption has been to dump sacks of food in areas where people are hungry. And what we're seeing now is a more sophisticated response where there are different tools available. But at the end of the day, the situation we're seeing across the Horn of Africa at the moment is a series of failed rains, a series of failed crops. And in large parts of the northern arid parts of the Horn of Africa, there is simply no food. If people were given cash, they wouldn't have anything to spend it on.
Rob Crilly, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Rob Crilly is a freelance reporter. We spoke to him from his home in Nairobi, Kenya. Recognize the sound? You've probably been hearing it a lot lately, but this is not the World Series. It's little leaguers on a field in Africa. That's ahead on the World Vision Report. Misina notis di turbada, misina notis ma medunyu, misti ojao guna luta, ma kujitu tenku luta, sin vingança buna vensi. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Baseball's not very popular in Africa. In fact, most people don't know what a baseball bat looks like or sounds like. One young man wanted to change that. That story's ahead. But first, a Colombian lawmaker has escaped after 8 years in a jungle prison camp. A guerrilla fighter from the rebel group that kidnapped him walked out of the jungle with him. The government rewards FARC guerrillas who turn themselves in with hostages. The rebel in this case gets to start a new life in France. And that's exactly why other guerrillas are willing to turn themselves in. But as Conrad Fox reports, not all of them are getting such sweet deals.
Paisa is tired and hungry and afraid. He's now in a secret location, but he fears both the right-wing paramilitaries that until recently he was fighting and his former colleagues in the FARC. If they catch him, desertion can mean death. Even so, he says he's glad he quit. So why did he join in the first place?
En ese momento estaba en una situación económica demasiado.
I was in a really bad way economically. I didn't have anywhere to live. I didn't have a steady job. So when I heard them promising people that if they joined the guerrillas, they'd look after you, give you benefits, well, really, I just joined out of necessity.
And for the excitement. The guerrillas told him he'd love the fighting. It's like playing sports, they said. But after Paisa witnessed executions of local villagers who refused to cooperate with the FARC, he swears he didn't participate. That excitement wore off.
It didn't seem like a sport, shooting fellow Colombians, shooting off people's heads with a bullet. That's when you realize that it isn't a sport, that you're in a group that's making life impossible for human beings, people who aren't to blame. I feel like crying. Hurting innocent people who have nothing to do with this?
Paisa snuck away from his unit after he saw a government TV ad offering financial help to rebels who surrender. He turned himself in at a nearby army post. For the next few days, he'll be interrogated, then set up in a safe house, given a monthly stipend for food, and enrolled in job training. It's all part of an ambitious amnesty program that's lured 46,000 fighters from the FARC and right-wing paramilitary groups out of the conflict. It comes at a cost. $7 million a month just for the stipends.
It's cheaper than to have the risk of having these demobilized people in the armed groups.
Jimena Samper, who runs the agency that helps the former combatants find work, says the cost is worth it.
We've been in an armed conflict from the 50s, so it's necessary for us to give opportunities to the demobilized people who want to reintegrate to society. If we don't do it, it's a risk for our society, for our private enterprises, for our economy.
A group of seven men shovel topsoil into bags for replanting trees. I never thought I'd be doing this, says one. They're ex-paramilitaries, or so I'm informed by their supervisor here at Bogota's fragrant and well-kept botanical gardens. 3 years ago, they sought amnesty, and they're now part of a government-funded on-the-job training program. When they finish, it is hoped, they will be able to find work as landscapers or gardeners. Unlike Paisa, the recent FARC fugitive, these men look relaxed and unafraid. But privately, they are not optimistic. Their stipends have been cut back to $200 a month, less than the national minimum wage, and they have to meet a series of conditions to receive the money, like psychological counseling. I'm not crazy, says one of the men, William. I just can't find work.
For us, it's difficult. I've been looking for work for 2 years. I've taken training as a security guard for warehousing, everything. But when you go in with your resume to a job and they see you're a demobilized fighter, they just close the doors on you.
Some ex-fighters have been so disillusioned they have taken to public protest, even staging a sit-in at the Bogota Cathedral a few months ago. But their critics say they're just getting a free ride at taxpayers' expense. And almost 4,000 fighters who took the amnesty have disappeared. There are fears some of them may have joined the ranks of a new wave of paramilitary groups sweeping the country. And it's known that an estimated 700 have been killed, many by their former comrades. Meanwhile, although Jimena Samper says about half of all demobilized fighters have found temporary work at some time or other, only a mere 101 have full-time jobs. As for the others?
Probably in 5 or 10 years. So if we have to stay 5 or 10 years to help this reintegration process, we will do that.
Wow. Do you have 5 or 10 years?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a risk, but we cannot do any more. I mean, we are doing everything we can, but obviously there are not 36,000 and 46,000 jobs right now.
But back at the Bogota Municipal Gardens, the amnesty has achieved at least one small victory. I had been told the ex-fighters working here were all right-wing paramilitaries. And the camaraderie among them did indeed suggest they were all on the same side. But while they sit on tree stumps and share their anger at the government for what they see as shortfalls in the amnesty program, I discover my information is wrong. William was a paramilitary, yes. But his friend Wilson is from the left-wing FARC, Another man is from another rebel group, the ELN. At various times, all of these groups have engaged each other in bloody battles. That means nothing here, says William.
Now we're fighting for the same cause, because we feel cheated by the government.
Only this time, hopefully, fighting with words, not with arms. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Bogota, Colombia.
Soccer is the sport of choice across most of Africa, but in the West African country of Ghana, baseball is on the rise. Baseball was introduced by American expats in the 1980s, but it never took off. Today, there are just a few hundred baseball players in the whole country. One of them is named Daniel. Daryl Harvey tells us his story.
Daniel Etiemo was 6 years old when he saw some men playing a strange game with a stick and a ball near his school in the port city of Tema. He asked them what they were playing.
It's baseball. I said, what is baseball?
They explained, and soon Daniel was playing too. Then he saw something on television that he'll never forget. It was a short clip of slugger Sammy Sosa hitting a home run. It was then Daniel started to dream big.
That was the vision I have, to be like one of those players.
Daniel's mother didn't share in that vision.
But mom said, yes, I want you to stop playing that game. That game, you can't play. This game, they play it in America. They don't play it in Ghana.
Daniel's mother feared her son would waste his time playing a sport that would never take him anywhere. Soccer is the path to sports stardom here. Plus, she didn't have the money to pay for baseball equipment. But Daniel found a way to play anyway. He caught the eye of a coach who gave him a glove and put him on a team. Today, the 19-year-old is one of Ghana's best players. Daniel practices on a patchy cricket field at the University of Ghana. There are no proper baseball diamonds here. He crouches low, snaps up a ground ball, and fires it back to the batter, who hits it back again. The speedy second baseman plays for the country's national team, the Rising Stars. But his team isn't part of a professional league. They don't exist in Ghana. So Daniel earns his living as an electrician's assistant. He plays baseball because he loves it.
Go, you can do it, boy. Let's go.
Here at the university, Daniel has started running informal clinics to teach others how to play the game. Not many people show up.
Sometimes I train only 4 people. Sometimes I train 10 people. Sometimes 12.
Today, a dozen students wearing t-shirts, shorts, and sneakers have come out to learn. Daniel runs them through some simple catching drills before giving them a chance to swing the bat. Most of them have never seen a baseball glove, let alone try to catch with it.
They don't know anything about the game. I'm now showing them what they use the bat for, and now showing them what they use the glove for, because sometimes those players are playing, they don't know that they use their glove to catch the ball.
Albert Okren is president of Ghana's fledgling baseball and softball association. He says the sport is out of reach for many Ghanaians. Baseball equipment is expensive and hard to come by. These financial barriers make it hard for the sport to grow and compete with Ghana's first sporting love, soccer, also called football.
Children can play football with anything. Just get an orange, something round, and they can play at any corner. Baseball also requires a kind of space. You know, it's very difficult to get space to play baseball.
Hold on. In Ghana is played on dirt soccer fields like this one in Tema. A set of goalposts stands smack dab in the middle of what's supposed to be center field. But the little leaguers on the field today don't seem to mind. They run, bat, and catch with agility. In fact, the athletic ability of these youngsters has attracted the attention of some major league officials in America. Delegations of them have visited Ghana twice in the last year to cultivate interest in the sport. Vice President of the San Diego Padres, Dave Winfield, was among them.
We're surprised at the level of talent here. When you can make plays on dirt infields like this, give them a manicured field and they'll be great.
Last year, Daniel Etiemo got a chance to play on one of those manicured fields. He traveled to the New York Mets spring training camp to try out for the team. He didn't make the cut. He has hopes that one day he'll make it back, But without regular games or a proper field to play on, he says it'll be tough. Still, he says, even if he never makes it to the major leagues, he's got a bigger dream.
I want to see baseball playing in every school, any place like the way they play soccer. And then I'll be happy. So I'm never going to give up in baseball.
He says he's determined to make Ghana a baseball nation. That way, he says, at least he'll have more people to play with. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daryl Harvey in Accra, Ghana.
This week, we're introducing you to a new contributor to the show. His name is Tendai Maposa. You may have heard him here before. He's a reporter from Zimbabwe. He's also our new guide to global music. We'll be starting off with Tendai's home country of Zimbabwe and its most famous musician, Oliver Mtukudzi. Tuku, as he's also known, still performs before packed audiences in his own country, even though Zimbabweans are fighting soaring inflation and food shortages.
What makes Oliver so popular is that he's singing about us and our everyday experiences. And I think he strikes a chord. That's why he's so big here.
And he's been around for a long time. He was writing music during the Rhodesian regime that was very repressive. And then when Zimbabwe gained its independence, he wrote celebratory music. And now, of course, under Mugabe, he has really helped his fans walk through this difficult period.
Yeah, Oliver has been around forever. He started off in the 70s, and I think his first single, it was just him and his guitar. And then he started singing with a band. And as you rightly say, he's been writing songs about our experiences from those days and also right through independence up to now.
What are the themes he's been writing about? What would be the prevalent themes?
Well, Oliver has always made it a point, made it very clear that he's not a political commentator. He's a musician. And I think that the issue that is really hammered time and time again in his music is the AIDS pandemic. As you know, Zimbabwe is in the middle of the Southern African region, which is the hardest hit in the world. And Oliver has really made a contribution in terms of addressing that particular topic.
What would be one of your favorite songs of Oliver's that has to deal with the AIDS pandemic?
I think Todi is one of the very, very best songs that where he addresses the issue. The Todi is what shall we do? He also refers to marital rape in a way, saying, you know, this it's so painful for a woman to have to give in to having sex with the husband, to be forced into having sex while the husband knows that he's HIV positive.
That's what that song speaks about?
Yeah, that's what it speaks about, and also just asking what shall we do about this very, very, very serious problem that we are facing.
Let's talk about some more of his music that really evokes a sense of Zimbabwe.
Another song that I would say really strikes a chord here in this country is the song called Tozeza Baba, which is we are afraid of our father, because it's about a domestic violence. He's saying our father, besides being a drunk, when he comes home, he also beats up our mother. So These are the sort of issues that Oliver really, tries to address in his music.
You know, it's interesting you say that song is about domestic violence, which is a serious issue in many parts of the world, but certainly in Zimbabwe also. And yet, that's a very depressing topic, but the music is very upbeat. You almost want to dance listening to it. That's interesting, combining those kinds of lyrics with such upbeat music.
I think that's a very African thing. Africans, I think all over the continent, have this thing of, you know, addressing very serious issues to very music that really sounds happy.
Has he been giving concerts in Zimbabwe during this last year of political turmoil?
Oh, yeah. He recently came back from a European tour, and he gave a free concert on his birthday.
How many people showed up?
Oh, thousands of people. Free concert?
Now, who are his fans? Is it young Zimbabweans or people in his generation? Who comes to these concerts mostly?
Right across the board. You know, young people love Oliver, you know. Older people, of course, and but, you know, everybody, you know, he sings for and to the people of Zimbabwe, and everybody loves him.
How would people in Zimbabwe, if I were to meet a Zimbabwean on the street and ask about Oliver, how would they describe their most famous musician?
I think a lot of people would just tell you that he has brought a lot of pleasure into their lives, and he talks about their own experiences, and he's a nice guy, a regular guy.
I'd like to close on a song that's popular called Rocky. And first of all, what does Rocky mean?
You know, that's a Shona translation of luck, English, L-U-C-K. But we don't have L in Shona, so it's just Rocky. Oliver is talking about how some people, you know, see their good fortune as being lucky, you know, going through life and saying, well, you know, I've been so lucky. And yet they do not sometimes, or they forget to acknowledge that there might be somebody there who's watching over them.
So does he have a spiritual dimension to his music as well?
Yeah, there is always that underlying element of spirituality, if you will.
Tendai Maposa is our guide to global music. He spoke to us from his home in Zimbabwe. For more information about Oliver Mtukudzi, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. And stay tuned to hear what's at the top of the charts in Nigeria. That's all ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In northern Nigeria, women writers are churning out best-selling novels on their personal computers. The stories are about love, romance, and marriage. Women love the books, but local religious and political leaders don't. This is a deeply conservative society, and Islam is the main religion. Open discussion of love and marriage is frowned upon. But the authors claim they're providing a service. They say the books give women much-needed social support. The fictional tales offer real-life advice to millions of women. Sarah Simpson has more from the northern city of Kano.
At open-air bookstalls, women look over the latest romance novels written in the language of the Hausa tribe, the dominant ethnic group in this region. The colorful covers display titles like False Love and City Lady. The books are popular throughout the north of Nigeria, and particularly here in the largest city, Kano. That's why they're often referred to as Kano market literature. Essentially, this is chick lit Hausa style. The books provide big sisterly advice on everything from polygamy to parenting. Most of the women perusing the titles today wear headscarves, a common custom here in the Muslim north. None of them wanted to speak publicly about the books, but in the privacy of an office, 23-year-old Mariam Mohammed Haladu did. She explains that the books provide important guidance since many parents don't openly discuss subjects like sex, love, and marriage with their children.
They tell them, but not everything. They won't tell you anything now, you know. Especially our maybe grandparents, even our mothers. Although now we are in the modern society, everybody is civilized. We know they will tell you a lot of things, but there are certain issues that they won't even tell you unless you know it by yourself.
For Haladu, who is single, the books have taught her a bit of what to expect from marriage.
If you are getting married, at least you have to know all to do, what to do, how to respect your husband and everything.
Though these books have been available for decades, access to personal computers and low-cost publishing houses means that more women writers are churning out the books than ever before. A novel can sell for as little as 20 cents, making them widely affordable. Balarat Rama Yakubu has written a half dozen novels. Two of them were reprinted so many times that she stopped counting at 150,000. Considering that every copy is shared and passed around many hands, or read aloud to non-readers, that's a huge audience. Yakubu, who's 53, believes her books are popular because her characters have to grapple with common problems Hausa women face. Problems that she's dealt with in her own life.
I'm a victim of most of the problems because I...
Yakubu's voice trails off and she appears upset. In almost a whisper, she explains that she was married at age 13.
My first husband is older than my father.
Yakubu didn't meet her husband until the day she was taken to his house to live in a polygamous marriage. In Islam, men are permitted to have up to four wives at any time. So in Yakubu's novels, readers can follow characters as they learn to live with co-wives. Such books provide a rare and frank discussion about the often unacknowledged rivalry that exists in polygamous households. But some believe that the books actually do the opposite.
Early days, people, they live in polygamy peacefully. But now, the people who read this, they are more jealous than before.
That's Sheikh Ibrahim Khalil, the head of Karno's Muslim Clerics Association. Khalil says the books encourage open discussion of love, which is not traditional in Hausa culture, and such discussion stirs jealousy and tensions in polygamous households. At a recent ceremony here, politicians publicly burned some of the books. The region's traditional leader, the Emir of Karno, presided at the event and denounced the books as pornographic. To a Western reader, the subject matter is tame. There are no graphic sex scenes, for example, but depictions of dancing and unchaperoned courtship openly challenge Hausa tradition. Another writer, Binta Rabiu, is 34 and single. She says she does not want to challenge Hausa society, but wants to use the books to explore how Hausa society can deal with modern-day problems. Here, she reads a passage from her book, Sultana, in which the heroine, a doctor, gives advice about drug abuse. Sultana is telling the children off for smoking marijuana, but also offers advice to parents. Unhappy marriages, she warns, can drive children away from parents and encourage them to find refuge in drugs. She says she writes as a service to Hausa society, a deeply traditional society that is being challenged by outside influences.
Women are not only writing for pleasure or something. No, we are writing because we are seeing what is happening in the society and we want a lot of corrections. We want amendment made. So that's why we write.
But not everyone agrees that the books are a service. Abdul Kadir Dangambo is a professor of Hausa literature and culture at Bayero University in Karno. He says the books promote notions of love and marriage that have more in common with foreign romance films than Hausa tradition.
I'm not saying that love does not exist in Hausa, but the way it is shown.
I'm not saying that love does not exist in Hausa, but the mode, the way it is shown. We have our traditional way of showing love.
For example, if you want to marry a girl, you have to go to the house.
For example, if you want to marry a girl, you have to go to her house.
You get a small boy and send him inside
to call her.
When she comes out, she will come.
When she comes out, she will not be alone. She will come with a small girl or a small boy, and then they will talk.
Dangambo says this traditional way of courtship is dying out, and the books are partly to blame. But regardless of the criticism they've drawn, the book's popularity looks likely to grow. That's because local filmmakers have recently started adapting the books into Hausa language movies, available on DVD. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sarah Simpson in Kano, Nigeria.
Now we know what people are reading in northern Nigeria. Let's hear what people are listening to in that country. This song was top of the charts last week in Lagos. Because if you day somewhere, I could find you. And if you day out there, I could find you. Where you day, girl? Because I day here. I'm looking for a chick where you stay well. Because if you day somewhere, I could find you. And if you day out there, I could cry your shoulders every day. Don't you know? That's top of the charts right now in Lagos, Nigeria. Music often fills bustling streets in the developing world, but so does this sound. Tamales, tamales, los tamales. That's the sound of street vendors. They sell everything from tamales to typing lessons. In our latest street vendor segment, we go to the town of Chichicastenango. Every Thursday and Sunday, you'll see people from all over Guatemala at the market there. It's one of the biggest in Latin America. Most of the vendors are descendants of the ancient Maya. They're famous for hand-woven textiles. Reporter Amelia Shaw met a Mayan woman there who's been weaving for decades.
Every Thursday for the past 30 years, Henara Lopez has traveled more than 3 hours by bus over mountain roads to get to this sprawling market in Chichicastenango. The 56-year-old sits on the ground next to a vendor selling chili peppers, watermelon, and honey. She sells huipiles, the traditional cotton weave blouses worn by Mayan women.
Que los huipiles para nosotros es sagrado.
For us, huipiles are sacred, she says. We are many Mayan cultures, Poponchies, Quechí, Quiché, Xinca.
Pero para toda esta familia Maya, Garífuna y Xinca, la ropa es sagrada.
And for the entire Mayan family, clothing is sacred. Sacred clothing may seem like a strange concept, but Lopez says it's at the heart of the designs. She rummages through the pile of brightly embroidered blouses on her lap and pulls one out. The fabric is burnt sienna in color, overlaid with designs in gold, silver, and deep brown.
Mire, esta que le estoy enseñando aquí es esta de parte de la naturaleza.
This one talks about nature, she says. Here you see deer, some huts, and men and women. Everything here is a part of our vision of nature, our cosmology, the plants and animals, the things we respect. Most women outside the capital city still wear huipiles. Every village has a distinct color and style. Here in Chichicastenango, the local Quiché women traditionally embroider three panels with large intertwined roses. But Lopez's huipiles use that chupil technique of the Quechí Indians, where figures are braided or twisted on the fabric. So her huipiles attract a lot of attention here. A local Quiché woman approaches Lopez and asks the price of the burnt sienna huipil in her hand. It costs 1,600 quetzales, about $200, a small fortune to a rural Mayan woman. But a huipil can last for up to 30 years. The Quiché woman walks away empty-handed. Lopez shrugs and says she still makes enough money to live on because Mayan women prefer to wear huipiles over cheaper, modern clothes.
Bien, sí, de eso como, de eso vivo, ya tengo 56 años y de eso he vivido.
She says, I've lived my entire life selling huipiles. This is how I survive, how I eat. I was even able to send my sons to study engineering at university by selling them. It takes a long time to weave a huipil, about 3 months, so Lopez's daughters and nieces help her. She says the collaboration helps keep the tradition alive, but she worries about the next generation.
Aquí la ignorancia nos está matando, pero esta es culpa del Estado.
Ignorance is killing us, she says. Children are growing up nowadays watching TV. They have no idea what their clothing represents. I think it is the fault of our government. They need to do more to educate people about our culture.
Esas solo en chiquitas tengo.
No, en grande.
No, en grande no traje ahora.
A veces trae grande.
Sí, pero ahora no traigo.
Another woman comes up and fingers a small red blouse with multicolored embroidery of women, flowers, and corn. She's looking for a huipil for her daughter. Lopez looks pleased. She says that if parents teach their children the importance of the huipil, traditional Mayan clothing, along with their business, will continue long into the future. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia Shaw in Chichicastenango, Guatemala.
The Muslim world recently celebrated the end of Ramadan. It's a month of fasting with feasts every night. And the biggest feast of all occurs on the final night. We asked Usman Barry to tell us what this festival means to him. He's a French teacher in Mali, where 90% of the people are Muslim. Here's Usman Barry in his own words.
We have rice with meat and fish also, depending on the families. And we have also couscous, just like couscous Arab, you know, the Morocco couscous. And also we have what we call to. To is a typical food for Bambara people. It's a big party, and depending on the tribes, you know, because, you know, in every family, depending also on what they can afford, most people just go to the mosque, you know. When they go to the mosque, the rich people, they cook food and take it to the mosque and then help poor people, those who can't afford it. You know, those who can afford it, they just help. It's a kind of solidarity among the people. So, you know, people just go and ask the neighbors for forgiveness and their friends, you know. So it's a time to get more blessings, more divine blessings. It means a lot to me because, you know, it's a time when people think that maybe they have been forgiven by God, you know, especially the sins. Those who committed sins, it's time for them maybe to think that well, in the years to come or maybe next year, maybe they will change their life, you know, and they will think of poor people. It means a lot to me.
Usman Barry is a French teacher in Mali. He spoke to us by cell phone. This week, a court in Niger issued a groundbreaking ruling against slavery. Child slavery is still practiced in Niger and in other developing countries, even though it's against the law. The Niger court blamed the government for failing to protect the rights of a woman who was sold into slavery as a child. It awarded her financial damages, sending a signal to governments everywhere who turn a blind eye to child slavery. Today, we hear from a young boy who grew up as a slave in Ghana. Prue Clark has this reporter's notebook.
I met 13-year-old Neva in his village in Ghana just days after he'd been freed from slavery. For 3 years, he'd been enslaved to a local fisherman. Despite his ordeal, Neva was so bright and charming, he made a big impression on me. But malnourishment had left him no bigger than a 6-year-old, and he trembled when he spoke of his time as a slave.
If I eat, I don't satisfy.
Even when I ate, I was never satisfied.
He and 5 other slave children, including his younger brother and sister, rose every morning at 5 and worked hauling nets and preparing fish until sunset.
Sometimes if I done something wrong, they beat me.
If I did something wrong, they beat me mercilessly.
Like I am a slave.
Like I was a slave.
Neva showed me scars on his arms where he'd been struck with nail-studded paddles. He saw fellow child slaves drowned or beaten to death. The master told him a child's death should serve as a warning to him to behave. A United Nations-backed aid group, the International Organization for Migration, bought Neva's freedom. I met him at his local school, where he and dozens of other ex-slaves were trying to catch up on their childhoods. They're some of the lucky ones. Thousands more poor children in West Africa are sold as slaves into domestic work, farming and prostitution. Neva's father was typical of the men who'd made that bargain. Napoleon Hadza had 21 children with 5 wives. Polygamy is a tradition in West Africa, and having many children gives a man status. A subsistence farmer in his 60s, Hadza didn't have a hope of feeding them all. It grieved him terribly, he claimed, but he felt he had no choice when a fishing master offered him $100 a year for each child he sold. If he had his time again, Hadza swore, he'd never have so many children. The fishermen who bought the children were in a bind too. Dwindling fish stocks meant they couldn't pay adults. Child labour was their only hope of making a living. With some exceptions, the adults in this story were not mean, just desperate people resorting to desperate measures. The aid group hoped to treat all aspects of the problem, getting the children out of slavery and into school and giving parents and fishermen the tools to start new businesses that were more profitable. It managed to save about 550 kids, but eventually its funding ran out. I went back to visit Never a year after I first met him. He'd grown a foot and was at the top of his class. He said he wanted to be a teacher. He also wanted to teach people the value of education so no more children would have to know what it's like to be a slave.
I want to teach my friends and tell them some story.
I want to teach my friends and tell them some story about my life so they can learn something.
I fish, but I learned something from it.
I fished, but I learned something from that.
I learned forgiveness. Mm-hmm. I learned forgiveness from that.
Never's father, meanwhile, seemed to have shrunk. The family no longer feared him. Instead, they held him in contempt. But the last time I saw him, the man who regretted having too many children had one more. His 22nd.
That's correspondent Prue Clark. And that's the end of our show this week. Remember, you can hear us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can download a podcast there. You can also post a blog or make a comment about the show. We'd love to hear from you. Our production team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Christina Darden, Doug Fox, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Larry Short, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.